This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, May 11th. I'm Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on the magazine today, the University of Colorado president is leaving after less than 3 years on the job. An award-winning Denver-based journalist is set to release his book tonight about a high-profile shooting in The Holly in the summer of 2013. We'll hear from the author. At the bottom of the hour, we'll play our weekly comment line, comments from listeners who share their thoughts about what they hear on KGNU. At 8:30, it's How on Earth. The KGNU Science Show team talks with CU Boulder scientist and entrepreneur Larry Gold about his Gold Lab Symposium. At 9 a.m., it's The Wit and Wisdom of Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, the Morning Sound Alternative, 2.5 hours of eclectic music until noon. But first, it's time for local and regional headlines. The Food and Drug Administration has given emergency authorization for the use of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccination in children as young as 12. Here in Colorado, middle and high school-aged kids make up the group with the fastest growth in coronavirus cases. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, is expected to give its green light as early as Wednesday. Colorado is set to receive almost $4 billion as part of the pandemic recovery efforts. KGNU's Steve Miller says on Monday, the U.S. Treasury started issuing the promised funds, including $83 million for Boulder and Boulder County.
The money comes from President Joe Biden's American Rescue Plan, a $1.9 trillion package the president signed into law in March. The Denver Post reported Monday that nearly $974 million is for the state and local governments nationwide, directed to cities, counties, and towns that can be spent in several ways. The money comes in two installments, with half arriving this month and the other half in May of 2022. Funding can be spent on things to improve public health, address the economic downturn, replace lost tax revenue, increase pay for essential workers, or invest in broadband, water, and sewer infrastructure. Gene Sperling, the White House's American Rescue Plan coordinator, said that 1.3 million state and local jobs have been lost since the onset of COVID and that the majority are local government jobs. Colorado's state government alone will receive $265 million. The city of Boulder is to receive $20 million, and Boulder County, $63 million. And nearly $974 million will go to the Denver metro area. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
A coalition of conservation groups is suing the federal government over authorization for 35 fracking wells across 35,000 acres of Colorado's western slope. The plan was approved during the Trump administration. The lawsuit, brought by groups including the Center for Biological Diversity, Wild Earth Guardians, and Citizens for a Healthy Community, argues the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service failed to conduct an adequate assessment of the environmental impacts of allowing the fracking wells to operate in drought-prone public lands. Colorado has become the second state in the country to allow for human composting. Governor Jared Polis signed into law a bill similar to those in Washington and California that allow for placing a body in a container with organic material so it will break down naturally. Lawmakers in New York and Oregon also are considering human composting legislation. While Governor Polis has signed the bill into law, it will take time for Colorado funeral homes to make the service available. Natural reduction costs about $6,000, which is not necessarily less expensive than a typical cremation, which in Denver is between $3,000 and $5,000 with a memorial service. Yesterday, jury selection began for a criminal trial in Denver that the accused, his attorney, and their allies feel exposes a double standard for people of color claiming self-defense. KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers has more.
Opening arguments are taking place this morning in the People v. Martinez case in Denver District Court. The case is based on a death that took place on New Year's Day 2020. According to Denver attorney Jason Flores-Williams, his client, Elijah Martinez, who was 18 at the time, stabbed 15-year-old Wiley Alvarado Gonzalez after Alvarado Gonzalez and his friends pursued and confronted Martinez's friend group near a Denver 7-Eleven. Flores Williams claims his client was defending his friend group and that his client was greatly influenced by trauma inflicted by growing up in a violent neighborhood where Martinez had been targeted in the past. In one of multiple traumatic situations cited by Flores Williams, Martinez is said to have been robbed at gunpoint, stripped of his clothes, and forced to run home in his boxers. Flores Williams is comparing this case to the cases of the subway vigilante Bernard Goetz in New York and George Zimmerman, both situations where the shooter claimed they were acting in self-defense and were celebrated by some as heroes who were protecting themselves. He's saying his client's history as a victim of violent crime should be taken into account, and he feels if his client were white, affluent, and the incident happened in a place like Boulder or Cherry Creek, he's doubtful Martinez would be facing first-degree murder charges. The victim, Wiley Alvarado Gonzalez, moved to the U.S. from Guatemala a year before his death, and according to his mother, the two were making up for 10 years they spent apart. She is calling for justice and says she continues to mourn the tragic loss of her son. The People v. Martinez case is expected to continue through this week. For KGNU, I'm Hanley Myers.
The unanimous choice for Boulder's new city manager is scheduled to be introduced at a meeting of the Boulder City Council tonight. Nuria Rivera Vandermeed was most recently deputy city manager for Austin, Texas. She will become the first female city manager of color in Boulder's history and the second female city manager. City Council appoints the city manager, who was most recently Jane Brautingham, Boulder's first female city manager and the longest-serving Boulder city manager in modern history, who served as the city's top executive for 12 years. Finally, Colorado Senator Michael Bennett announced his re-election campaign for U.S. Senate on Monday. The Democrat is up for re-election in 2022. He has served Colorado in the Senate since 2009. The weather forecast for the Front Range this second Tuesday of May: more snow and rain with a high of 40 degrees, low tonight of 33. Then warmer for tomorrow with a high of 56, and by Thursday, near 70. Right now outside our Boulder studios, it's 36 degrees. You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Less than 3 years into the job, University of Colorado President Mark Kennedy is leaving. That follows a statement on Monday that Kennedy has not resigned, but expects to transition out of the position in the near future. The announcement comes after recent votes by faculty and students to censure Kennedy over leadership issues. KGNU's Roz Brown spoke with a former CU regent who said the odds were against Kennedy from the outset.
The hiring process of Mark Kennedy was flawed, fundamentally flawed.
That's former CU regent Jim Martin, who served on the board for 6 years in the 1990s.
And actually, I felt sad for Mark Kennedy. I still do. He should never have been offered the job. And better yet, he should never have taken the job.
Kennedy, a former Republican congressman and president of the University of North Dakota, was a controversial choice as president of the four-campus system when selected by the Board of Regents in 2019. As Martin notes, the vote was 5-4, with majority-led Republicans supporting the selection and Democrats opposed.
The odds of trying to run, in this case, a $4.5 billion state entity is greatly diminished if you don't have full support of the board.
A regular contributor to the Boulder Daily Camera opinion page, Martin argues that the Board of Regents in 2019 held sham listening sessions with CU students but failed to acknowledge any meaningful input.
So as we know, the process started with really, I think, an inadequate search process. And then when he asked probative questions like, where do you stand on affirmative action? And he says, I've got to get back to you on that question. One had better be more prepared. That's a simple question. That's a softball that one ought to, particularly a president, be able to quickly come back with a response.
During a meet and greet at Boulder's Mackey Auditorium in 2019, students were not shy in their disappointment that he was the sole finalist to lead CU. that disappointment has not waned. Chair of the CU Faculty Assembly, Bob Ferry, tallied last month's 35-19 vote to censure Kennedy for lack of leadership.
He's not proactive in a positive way, doesn't lead us well enough, and worse, he said things, some of which he apologized for, you know, but we want more black faculty, we want more Hispanic students, we got to do important things, you know, make a difference. We're up against real problems here on this campus. Boulder's a difficult place for people of color to live because they're so, I mean, it's a numbers thing. I'm not saying Boulder's full of racists or anything, but the numbers. You have to drive to Aurora to get your haircut if you're a black man. There's nobody they're going to do it for you. It's a problem. So there are a lot of problems, and many of them we can't fix or not easily. So we have internal discussions all the time now. In a way, that's also part of the problem with Kennedy, that Boulder is way ahead. We haven't accomplished what we want to, but planning, diversity officers, faculty engagement, we're already trying our best to do things, you know. So there's a bit of a disconnect between the campus and the system on the whole question of diversity.
While only president for 2 years, Kennedy was accused of being a poor listener, which former Regent Martin says is not a good fit for a liberal arts institution.
Unlike a business, a university is run by the notion of shared governance. It's bottom-up management, and that's students, faculty, and staff opinions distill than what should be acted upon in the boardroom. Now, it's never perfect, but it's bottom-up, and it starts with the faculty.
Kennedy succeeded Bruce Benson, who led the campus as president for more than 10 years. The announcement of his impending departure comes a month before the Board of Regents meets for Kennedy's first evaluation since that board flipped to a Democratic majority in January. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
On the last evening of summer in 2013, 5 shots rang out in a part of Northeast Denver known as the Holly. While shootings there weren't uncommon, the identity of the shooter that night came as a shock. Terrence Roberts was a revered anti-gang activist and a former host on KGNU's Metro. His attempts to bring peace to his community had won the accolades of both his neighbors and the state's most important power brokers. Why had he just fired a gun? In The Holly, 5 Bullets, 1 Gun, and the Struggle to Save an American Neighborhood, the award-winning Denver-based journalist Julian Rubenstein reconstructs the events that left a local gang member paralyzed and Roberts facing the possibility of life in prison. In advance of this long-awaited book's launch this evening, live streaming at 6:30 p.m. from Dazzle in Denver, Rubenstein spoke with KGNU's Dave Ashton.
I end up calling the book and the prologue, it ended up feeling like an alternate history of a part of the city as well as a heavily covered shooting case. What I was finding did not match with what was publicly out there about the case or this place. This particular neighborhood, as well as it chronicles 5 Points, these 2 neighborhoods, historically African-Americans, and ultimately ended up becoming the 2 original gang neighborhoods in Denver, or the 2 original LA-style gang neighborhoods in Denver. I talk about the others. There were gangs before that here. Once the Crips and Bloods got here in the mid-80s, it really took a turn for the worse. Horrifically, these 2 African-American neighborhoods turned their guns against each other and went to war in an invisible war that very little is known about. For example, when you read things about shootings and about crimes or see it in the news, I was finding that there was a much different, of course, bigger story going on that wasn't told. And because I think it's very hard to access. But the other thing that I found in general was that the development of these neighborhoods, one might say the gentrification of these neighborhoods, I found very tied closely to the law enforcement efforts in these neighborhoods, and there was some troubling findings that I had about that.
It was actually a surprise of my young adulthood to see gang life coming back really strong at the turn of the millennium, and gangbanging was coming back kind of with a vengeance. Terrence Roberts stepped into this milieu with the Prodigal Son Initiative and was making a visible change. What can you share with us that you found out in your research for this book about what Terrence was faced with?
It becomes a question really, I guess, at the center of the book. you know, the book actually, I think of it as a multi-generational crime story. I mean, I realized when I went into this story thinking it's kind of a mystery story, like not exactly a whodunit, it's a why done it. We know who pulled the trigger. The question is why. I ended up realizing that to tell that story and to really understand it, I had to go back to the civil rights era and bring you all the way through. And the reason, you know, that there were a lot of echoes, one of the reasons, not even the only one, but the question that we know about, think about, you know, some of the black power leaders, civil rights leaders like Fred Hampton, who we know were targeted by law enforcement. Terrence Roberts' success came at a time when a lot of law enforcement money flowed into Denver. And in fact, at the time of the shooting, Terrence's organization was running the effort on the ground in Northeast Park Hill. And he began to feel, I certainly investigate this in the book, that there were people, connected gang members, who he felt were informants, who were trying to infiltrate the movement. Now, this is a saga that plays out throughout the book. Some of these things are difficult to suss out in terms of exactly what happened. When you get deep into this book and or if you pick it up, one question that I can say must be asked and is fair game to ask is whether Terrence Roberts was attacked by police informants. And there is some considerable evidence to suggest he may have been.
Police informants, meaning active gang members who are playing both sides of the fence, does that kind of relationship with law enforcement provide some protection for a informant to behave violently?
This is also something I look at in the book, and it's very problematic. The city of Denver, the way they're using their informants, needs more oversight, needs more accountability. There are violent gang members who have associations with law enforcement who are, according to the records I was able to obtain, shown to have been arrested or charged with multiple crimes that they are either dropped or not charged with, crimes that if I would have committed, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I'd be in a prison. We don't know much about what's going on there. And that's why it's one of the reasons why it took me so long to really dig into the records I was able to get into and do a huge amount of interviews and sourcing to try to find out who are these people, what are they up to, and the results were problematic.
And this is an ongoing situation. Although it focuses on a shooting in 2013, this is about the reality on the streets of Denver now.
Yes, in a way, the climax of the book. So you get to the almost end of the book where Terrence Roberts in 2015 is facing life in prison. He goes to trial. And sometimes it's good when you miss your book deadline. In this case, I missed my book deadline by a couple years, and that was fortunate in that 2020, which was a humongous year in so many ways, George Floyd's murder at the hands of the Minneapolis policeman who was just convicted of it, set off, obviously, all these protests. And among the protest leaders in Denver, one of the most powerful figures emerging was Terrence Roberts. And then it was September, I believe, of 2020, he was arrested and charged with a felony crime of inciting a riot and other charges for peaceful protests, by the way. I was at them, and I'm also, I know Terrence, I've been around him closely for years. He was arrested and told he'd been followed for months, and I would call it very good news that, guess what, they just dropped all of the felony charges against him and the other protesters. And it's ridiculous. Our law enforcement is targeting peaceful activists while hiring and working with violent gang members. I mean, something is wrong with this picture.
Again, that was KGNU's Dave Ashton speaking with author Julian Rubenstein. Time now for KGNU's Comment Line, when we hear what's on the minds of listeners.
Yes, I'm calling from Seattle, Washington. My name is Scott Wiley, and I just had a quick comment. I just spent yesterday, actually 2 days ago, calling about 100 members of Congress in the House of Representatives and the Senators. And it was regarding the January 6th insurrection on the Senate building where the Ashley Babbitt was murdered by retired Secret Service Director Joseph Clancy. And the only person in the entire batch of people that I was able to contact that called me back was the representative, Senator Bennett, and his staff from your area there. I just wanted to talk to you guys about releasing, making the information public. I'm just trying to find an area in America that has people that are still willing to stand up for justice and truth in America. Justice and truth. And that's all. Thank you. Bye.
Hi, I just finished listening to Kathy Partridge's interview about wealth hoarding on Friday morning. And I just was calling to say what a fabulous interview that was. I mean, I just thought the guest and what he was talking about was really interesting, and Kathy asked just all sorts of interesting questions. I just really, really appreciated the information I got and the way that she handled the whole interview. So I just wanted to say yay. Thanks a lot. Once again, glad for KGNU.
A reminder that if you'd like to share a comment with KGNU, call us at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25 during the Morning Magazine.
Drug policy and how we talk about drugs were hot topics at the 2021 Cannabis and Psychedelic Symposium hosted at the University of Colorado last month. We'll hear from one of the keynote speakers, Ingrid Walker. She's Associate Professor of Cultural Studies at the University of Washington, Tacoma, and researcher with the Drug Policy Alliance. Tune in Tuesday at 6 o'clock right here on KGNU's Hemispheres.
Thanks for tuning into the Morning Magazine today on KGNU. I've been your host, Shannon Young.